Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the producer and host of today's podcast, and I'm pleased to have Rosina Lozano with me to discuss her book, An American Language, The History of Spanish in the United States, published by the University of California Press in 2018. Dr. Lozano is assistant professor of history at Princeton University, where her research and teaching focuses on Latino history, the American West, migration and immigration, and comparative race and ethnicity. She has received fellowship support from several prestigious institutions, including the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, the New Mexico Office of the State Historian, the National Academy of Education, and the Spencer Foundation. Hello, Rosina, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hello, DJ. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm very excited. We've been in contact, obviously, before this, and I've seen different versions of the book and presentations, so for me, at least, this is really, you know, an anticipated conversation. I'm very excited to talk to you about your book. But to begin, I was wondering if we could just, if you would mind sharing a little bit about your personal and professional background with our audience.
Of course. So I come from a large Mexican-American family. My grandparents immigrated from Monterrey, Nuevo León, and Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua, in the 1950s. And they settled in California's Central Valley and worked as agricultural farm laborers. And my parents were both first-generation college students, and I grew up in and around college campuses, more specifically on UC Santa Cruz, where my parents were preceptors at Kresge College. I was actually born in Santa Cruz, and on Stanford University, where my father is a longtime administrator of diversity affairs. And after the age of 10, I grew up in Sunnyvale, which is between Stanford and San Jose. I attended Stanford University, where I was pre-med, believe it or not, as an undergraduate. And as a sophomore, I took Introduction to Race and Ethnicity with George Fredrickson and Al Camarillo. And that has really set me on the path to study Mexican-American history, though I was still pre-med when I decided to major in history. So I even had a research project with the medical school that involved coding simultaneous translations between doctors and patients. So I've been interested in language for a long time. Once I did my honors thesis under Al Camarillo's mentorship on the creation of the Community Service Organization, or the CSO, in East Los Angeles, I was really hooked. Al encouraged me to teach high school before committing to a PhD program, and I went to Harvard for a master's in teaching and curriculum right after undergrad. And I taught high school for 3 years after that and absolutely loved teaching, but I also very much missed research, and I knew that I wanted to both teach and conduct research. So that's, I just felt like there was too much missing in the textbooks, and I wanted to help fill those gaps. So I was really incredibly fortunate to attend and receive my PhD from the University of Southern California at a very exciting time with a large cohort of students studying Mexican American history and the history of the American West. I also benefited immensely from the mentorship of George Sanchez and Bill Deverell while I was at USC, and they guided me through my graduate coursework and dissertation. I still turn to them as I continue on my career as a historian, so they really are really important to my career. And due in part to the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West, I formed great friendships with graduate students and professors from all over Southern California at the Huntington Library. So working and researching there opened up so many opportunities for me. After I graduated from USC in 2011, I had a postdoc, as you mentioned, with the National Academy of Education Spencer Foundation. And I took that year at the Center for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity at Stanford. And just 5 years ago, I began here as an assistant professor at Princeton. It's really hard to believe that I've lived so far away from California for so long now. And while I've been here, I've benefited from just amazing colleagues and mentors, both at Princeton and across the country, more than I can mention here, but they've just been so generous with their time and have helped me to continue to grow as a historian and teacher. And they're definitely all over my book acknowledgments. So I'm really incredibly lucky.
You know, I'm interested, as you mentioned, the switch, you know, away from, you know, the...
Well, it was funny because my parents actually...
What did your parents and family think about
that? I wanted
that?
To be a doctor, really, but they weren't going to discourage me from that. So my mom's like, you never really loved seeing blood. So I didn't understand why you wanted to be a doctor. But that, so they never really pushed me in one way or another on that. And my mom's a teacher. She teaches third grade. My dad was an administrator. And I thought about whether I wanted to do administration or teach. And I decided that if I wanted to get a PhD, that I would, that it could benefit me to have that teaching background. And so that's why I chose to go that direction instead of getting a master's in higher ed and going more an administrative route.
You mentioned that language, you've long been interested in language. And of course, the title of the book has that at its center, an American language. And I'm particularly interested by, you know, the title itself, but I was wondering if you might explain first the image that's on the cover, because I think it's just a really well done cover. It looks great. What's that image that we see in the background, which our listeners will be able to click on and see during the podcast?
So the image on the background is a loyalty oath for the United States, and it's entirely in Spanish during the Civil War. So it says Territorio de Nuevo México. And if you look on the cover, you can see that it's Charles Leab and Thomas S. I don't know if it's Strymer or, you know, that's right, the other name, but both of them are not Spanish surnamed. And you kind of just get a sense for how New Mexico operated in Spanish from the cover. And it's very clearly the United States because it says Pluribus Unum and has the eagle right there on the cover. And so that was an image that I kind of talked to the press about. And then I was very lucky that they liked the idea and they went with it. And then the cover designer, I had actually wanted to have it be bilingual on the cover. So if you look, the cover has in red the title of the book, and then in blue it has it in Spanish, and all throughout, including my name in script, has everything in Spanish. So it says La Historia del Español en los Estados Unidos too. And that was something that they came up with, but I had actually wanted, but I didn't ask for it. And so I was very, very happy when they did that and chose to go in that direction. So it kind of all in the cover gives a sense for where the book is going.
No, exactly. That's exactly what it does. And I appreciate you and thank you for explaining that, because I had noticed, you know, the smaller text, you know, so the bilingual, the nature of the cover came across to me through that. But I even missed, you know, the subtlety of the blue cursive script with the, again, title. Well, that's just right underneath, you know, the red bold and American language. So thank you for pointing that out. And as you mentioned, it really does, I think, the cover, if you look and analyze it succinctly, you know, conveys the book's central argument, which I believe is, right, that the U.S. is and always has been a multilingual nation, right? And moreover, the particular subtitle here, The History of Spanish in the United States, this is more of a political history. Is that right? Can you expand a little bit about, you know, how is this a history of Spanish in the United States?
Yeah, you're right. It is more of a political history. It's a politics of the Spanish language in the United States. So I looked at translations and official use of Spanish, but I also looked at the ways that it was being incorporated into schools, because that's the next generation of who's going to be speaking a language, right? So if the language is offered, then that gives you a sense of how it's going to live in society. And just the politics of using a specific language on these official forms or on letters when you're writing to government officials, what does it mean to see those in Spanish rather than in English? And a lot of times things are translated, you know, for word count limits or things like that. I'm sure it's not necessarily the author's choice, but in this book, I explicitly make sure that everything is in its original Spanish when it is in there, so that people can really see how much people were using Spanish in these positions that are often thought of as being completely in English.
Right. And to continue on just the political history thread of this, so this is, as it became clearer to me, Because initially, again, reading the title, one would think, oh, okay, there's various ways, I guess, to interpret, the history of Spanish in the United States. But to me, it is very explicit with a subtitle that's within the formation of the U.S. nation, right? As opposed to like a very broad history of Spanish in the Americas, which would be quite different, right? So you could add a little bit or expand a little bit more on that part, the intersection at which that this book focuses on within, the role that Spanish plays in the formation of the United States itself.
Right. And so there's a lot of different ways that I argue this in the book, but for one example, so as more and more scholarship has been coming out on the 1840s, and I'm thinking of Brian DeLay's book or others that kind of talk about just how many the native empires were in control of a lot of the West at the time. What I began to see when I was reading the documents was that there was no pushback against using Spanish in these regions because the individuals who were settled there and who had the relationships with the native population, the indigenous populations that were in these regions, were Spanish speakers. And so the United States actually needed these individuals in order to set up the government in these new territories and states. And so it's both in California and New Mexico. New Mexico divides into many others, and so it gets complicated pretty quickly. But that's the central tenet, is that each of these spaces could not have begun to be a part of the United States without the use of Spanish.
Exactly, exactly. And so in that point, then, the starting point for the narrative then is 1848, right? With the conclusion of the U.S. and Mexico War. And the book itself is organized into two parts. The first five chapters included in a section that focuses on Spanish as a language of politics, right? And this goes from the end of the U.S.-Mexico War in 1848 to 1902. And then the second half, the remaining five chapters, is entitled, or it covers Spanish as a political language, right, from 1902 to 1945. So within the first section, as far as Spanish as a language of politics, in what ways can you expand on, that Spanish functioned as a language of politics? What do you mean by that?
Right. And so it depends on the location, but what I found was that Spanish was, there were translated session laws, there were legislative members who spoke Spanish, so they required interpreters in the legislatures at the time. There were court cases that were conducted entirely in Spanish. There were ballots, secretaries of elections were writing in Spanish the voting returns were to the territories and states. And so there's a lot of different ways that Spanish functioned as a language of politics in this earlier period. And again, it changes when, based on, geographically, it changes the time period. So I don't want to kind of go into that sort of detail, but that gives you a sense for what I mean by a language of politics. So it's used in official capacities in multiple different ways in these different places.
Great, great. And yeah, let's do that. Let's focus on the first half. So within this language of politics, you introduce a concept or a term called treaty citizens. Can you explain what that term is and how this group functions within what you were just explaining, making Spanish a language of politics within these new territories?
So people who are from Texas may have noticed that I have not mentioned Texas yet in my description of my book. And so treaty citizens is one of the reasons that treaty citizens is what I came up with for the reason why I don't include Texas. And so Texas, becomes a territory much like it leaves Mexico earlier. It also becomes a state of the United States prior to the U.S.-Mexican War. There were, of course, issues, Mexico not necessarily recognizing it and all that. But at the same time, Texas was not the same as these other parts of the Southwest that became part of the United States later. And they also had Anglo populations that were about 10 to 1, right, when that transfer occurred. And so they never really saw the same sort of language, Spanish as a language of politics in Texas as they saw in other parts. Whereas in New Mexico, there is, 95% of the population is Spanish speaking. some obviously spoke English too, but it's a very small number. And what they had in common with California, you know, they can't necessarily be traveling on a train to go in between or, you know, talking about how they're using Spanish, but they had that in common with the other individuals who also became citizens by this, by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, in California as well. So the treaty citizens are from 1848 in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in Article 9, the U.S. government in Mexico agree that all those residents who are in this ceded territory who were Mexican citizens would become U.S. citizens. And there's no proviso for race. There's no proviso for language in that. But all of those individuals, you know, at the stroke of a pen, they don't even know it at the time, right, become U.S. citizens. And some of them didn't want it, right? But they all become it at the same time. So that's what unites the large kind of geographical scope of the book is these treaty citizens.
Gotcha. Right. And so with the treaty citizens, you started to mention that and luckily, you know, recent scholarship and or scholarship over the last, you know, couple of decades has expanded on, you know, just how, you know, accessible, right, citizenship was, right, to these, you know, new members of, you know, the U.S. nation state. So can we get into a bit more specifics as to whose they were, right? Because there's, I guess, population figures, you know, vary, right, based, I think you state something around 50-something thousand, right, or so, are incorporated under this new category, but yet, right, obtaining those rights and benefits of citizenship as whether they're, you know, being claimed through the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was oftentimes tenuous, right, and wasn't just universally granted. So you can expand a little bit.
Yeah, so it does get pretty complicated in that who was considered a citizen under Mexico was not necessarily who the United States wanted to make citizens, right? And so you have the 1790 Naturalization Act, which doesn't really affect these individuals since they're not being naturalized. They're just being granted citizenship in a different sort of way. But that said only white individuals could become citizens of the United States, be naturalized, right? And you have all these tenuous kind of long history of citizenship of Native individuals. And perhaps unsurprisingly, those Native individuals, I mean, specifically the Pueblo Indians, who did have citizenship under Mexico, but again, gets complicated in terms of what their rights were in terms of voting or other sorts of things, but they did have citizenship, did not get citizenship. And so those individuals are not considered treaty citizens in my book. And so it's really these Spanish-speaking individuals, these individuals who would become Mexican-Americans rather than indigenous individuals who I cover in the book.
Great. Thank you. And within these treaty citizens, it seems that these are typically, at least some of the most obvious ones would be those that held property, right, already were within the existing class structures and political structures were the elite of the region. Is that appropriate?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely who left the records behind, most of the records that I was looking at. In terms of who actually becomes citizens, there are individuals that do not have property and who are voting pretty early on. So if I have these rolls from the 1860s that I found at the Huntington Library, these scrolls of voters, and, you know, 9 out of 10 of those individuals were Spanish surnamed individuals who most likely could not write since they did not write their name on the actual list of voters, but some did. So you can see the change in names. So especially in New Mexico, that was a larger group than just the elite that practiced the rights of citizenship. But definitely, the ones that were leaving behind a record were those elite that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. So, wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing, for example, a couple differences that you point out. So within the book, there's you know, the narrative arc. You know, if you will, covers how Spanish moves from, you know, this early language of governance in the mid-19th century for, you know, particularly in the territories of California and New Mexico, to one in foreignness. That foreignness is more of the second part of the book. But in the first half of the book, you do point out, or I guess, and even throughout, right, that there are these differing trajectories even within California and New Mexico and the other, you know, states that eventually form out of that broad New Mexico territory, which, you know, modern day, you know, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, primarily, right? So what is part of one of the key, you know, distinguishers as to how, you know, this successful, you know, these treaty citizens were at, you know, claiming rights and accessing rights through the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and, you know, really making Spanish, you know, at least an important aspect, right, of that transition from, Mexican governance to U.S. territorial governance?
So there's a huge difference in the territory that's ceded from Mexico pretty quickly, and that California becomes a state and rather than remaining as a territory. And part of the reason that it becomes a state is because of the gold rush and this huge influx of Anglo, but also, international miners coming into the region. And so you see the treaty citizens overtaken by this population of newcomers very quickly. And you see it as early as the state constitutional convention, where you have the vast majority of individuals that are there have not lived there for very long. But even in that case, where you would expect that they might dominate, there was still 8 individuals who could not speak the English language who were at that convention and who were giving their opinions and being a part of the government. And some of those individuals eventually became senators too. So there's a different, from that starting point of 1848 and of becoming treaty citizens, there's a pretty quick division between the two regions that is part of the reason that I wanted to look at it comparatively to see how it shifted. Whereas in New Mexico, there's many different debates and arguments over why New Mexico remained a territory for so long. But one of the things that I argue is that by remaining a territory, it was able to keep Spanish in such a central place for much longer than it was than what happened in California or other places. And part of that reason is because the Congress was supporting those translations and supporting the use of Spanish in the territory in a way that it didn't occur in other parts, because the New Mexicans just dominated the demographics of the territory so much more than, say, in Colorado, where it was really just the southern counties where the Spanish speaking mostly dominated. And they still had a significant amount of power. Colorado didn't want to lose these individuals, and so they were pushing for including translations. It's in their constitution that they would have translations until 1900, right? So while they're not operating the Colorado state government in Spanish at all, they still have these translations, and there's still this support, and there's a sense that there was power within the Spanish speaking community to have these sorts of official support for the language.
Great, thank you for that. And that comes across clearly as a key way in which, right, these treaty citizens claimed language rights, as you explained, early on in the book, was through advocating for translations, right? So making official documents bilingual, if you will. Were there other ways in which they pushed for these language rights aside from just translation itself? In official documents,
translations of official documents, use in the schools, continue to teaching in the schools, and at the local levels, it could be the courts, the judges. There's a lot of different ways that the language was used, even if the official translations weren't always in that language. So there's a broad array of ways that that more local story. I follow it even into the 20th century, where individuals are writing to political party officials in Spanish, right, and are getting responses in Spanish as well. So it's not just that they were advocating for it, but they were actually operating in Spanish in many of these places.
Yeah, and New Mexico is really the key, right, in particular, right, in that the Spanish was just so dominant, well, even in the 20th century. Is that correct? I mean, just not only in politics, but, throughout daily life itself, right?
Yes, throughout daily life, in the courts, in every facet of life, it was dominant. And in southern Colorado, it was similar. And then there's pockets of Arizona, but Arizona never had the same sort of support for the language as the rest of the territories.
Right. Yeah. And now I'm thinking of it. Actually, I probably glossed too much over this concept of language rights, which is really important, I believe. And you add quite a bit to, the discussion of it. You want to take a moment just to explain what maybe this, writings are, the history kind of language rights is, and how your book really adds depth to the concept and scholarship on language rights.
Right. So in many ways, language rights is a fairly new concept and a fairly new political, fairly new point of political mobilization, right? So it's only in 1996 that UNESCO issued the Universal Declaration of Linguistic Rights, and that really offered protections for minority language speakers. It maybe might be the right to be recognized as a member of that a particular language community. It would be the right to teach and to preserve the language, the right to have access to the language in media and official spaces, right? And the right to use one's language in both in public and private. And these individuals, treaty citizens, as I call them, were not, of course, looking to other societies and talking about language rights with them and trying to figure out how to advocate for them. It was absolutely necessary that Spanish was used in order for them to actually become citizens, right? So in many ways, the book is looking at the ways that this group of individuals who didn't speak Spanish were offered the opportunity to participate in citizenship, right? And so in some ways, language rights is anachronistic because people don't think of it in this earlier period. And in other ways, it was very organic for them, right? It made absolute sense, and it was what they needed in order to participate.
Thank you for that. So as we've covered, the first part of the book covers the treaty citizens, make their claims to language rights, in early form, again, something they don't articulate, but something we conceptualize and theorize about now. During this, first 50 or so year period, 54 years, I believe it is, up until about 1902. So 1902 becomes the dividing line for your narrative before we switch into the second half of the book, where Spanish is becomes more of a political language. So can you explain the division as far as, the year itself, and then what transpires as we move away from Spanish being used as this, official language where, the transition of governments is occurring and very much necessary, to then what happens after that?
Right. So 1902 is an important year for a couple of reasons. And one is because it's the year that these five senators go into New Mexico and begin to really ask a bunch of questions about what language is being used in society in New Mexico. And it's not like the Senate or, the Congress or even the Treasurer's Office didn't know that they were operating in Spanish. They did. I found many letters where they acknowledge that, but it was this attempt to kind of let the rest of the nation know that that's what was occurring, and so when they leave, the articles from New Mexico talk about Senator Albert Beveridge in particular as being an enemigo, like an enemy of New Mexico, because of what he had kind of. That he insinuated that they couldn't be both U.S. citizens and Spanish speakers. And that was a core part of their identity, right? And so that was the first year that the U.S. really kind of looks to the Southwest and in particular to New Mexico and says, they're different and we don't really like that. At the same time, that isn't what stops them from having statehood. That's a longer story. But what it does is it's allows for all of these different articles to go out where people are like, oh my goodness, I can't believe the courts are in Spanish. Oh my goodness, I can't believe you could meet somebody who's 19, born in the US and doesn't know English, right? And so there was this real recognition that that was occurring. And at the same time, the flip side and what links it to the second part of the book where it's no longer a language of politics, but becomes a political language is the idea that the irrigation that occurs in 1902. So the Newlands Reclamation Act is kind of the one of many of these acts, but it occurs in 1902 is probably the most famous of them, right? And that is what was really going to allow for but opens up this great need for farm workers, right? And farm laborers that brings in this huge influx of new Spanish speakers into that same region where treaty citizens had been, less so in New Mexico, but they go into Arizona, they go into California, they go in all over. And it's a replenishment of the language, but it's also a shifting of the language to a group who is not U.S. citizens, but who are immigrants and who are from Mexico. But as there's also, another date that happens right around the same time is, of course, in 1898, when the United States becomes kind of more imperial and colonial, like takes over the rest of Spain's lands, right? You get Cuba, you get Puerto Rico, the Philippines, all these different regions, and you have Spanish coming through Puerto Ricans in particular as well. And so that's another kind of addition of the Spanish language. But there's kind of a difference in the way that it's discussed in the West versus in Puerto Rico.
Right. So in many ways, so much of this is about changing demographics and migration trends and flows, if you will. Is that right? In regards to the perception of who's speaking Spanish, both, you know, within the region as that's changing, but also, you know, for the nation itself as it's, you know, expanding, right? I mean, this is the phase of the U.S. colonial phase, if we will, right? When they expand into the Caribbean and not only that, but into this Pacific. Right. So this is again where then Spanish is becoming more perceived as that language of foreignness that you explained earlier.
Yes, foreignness can be radical, right? You have individuals that are unionizing, you know, you have the Bisbee deportation in Arizona, you have individuals in California kind of being vilified for speaking Spanish, right? So there's a different sort of discussion that's occurring there. And then you still have individuals in New Mexico who continue to have leadership positions, who continue to be participating in political parties. But at the same time, it's starting to wind down. So there's kind of Spanish is multifaceted at this point in terms of what it means in the country and what it means to the expansion, right? So you have this kind of desire to Americanize these individuals and teach them English at the same time that you have all of these Pan-American aspirations as the nation does look towards a more colonial, first by taking land, later by going into different parts of Latin America for economic gain, right, or political gain. And so Spanish becomes highly valuable in those sorts of situations. So the second part of the book is kind of a little more messy because there's so much that Spanish can mean at that point to the nation. As the nation is growing itself, Spanish is growing and changing in the ways that it's being perceived by the federal government, by the state government, and by Spanish speakers themselves.
Right. Yeah. And as you begin, you know, with that, you know, so much of this is about, you know, the implications of, you know, between language and identity, right? Both individually, you know, personally too, but also to the nation itself. So this becomes a critical period where this is really in flux at all those different levels, right? Before we go to 1945 and or World War II and Pan-Americanism, which is where I'd like to go next, but I just got this thought, and I was thinking, so during this period of transition, you know, particularly into the 20th century, the initial decades, how is this affecting, you know, again, the changing politics and perceptions of Spanish itself? How are treaty citizens responding to these changes that are happening all around them, both the way in which they are perceived, their language is perceived, the demographic transition that's going on, which is very rapid, right? We typically tend to think of migration as something international, but this is a key moment, right, when the West is being heavily populated by domestic migration from the Northeast, from the Midwest, et cetera, right?
Yeah, so it's there's different reactions, as you might expect. So there's those who really support Americanization and say, you know, if we are going to be part of this country, we should learn English and Spanish should be more of a private language, no longer the language of government or the language of politics. You have individuals who are definitely having that side of the argument. A young Dennis Chavez kind of goes on that side. And at the same time, in these, you know, 19-teens, 1920s in New Mexico, you also have individuals who are very excited about the possibilities of Spanish and what they can bring to the nation by aiding them with teaching others Spanish, you know, having posts in Puerto Rico or the Philippines because they already know Spanish and they know the culture, or going into Latin America, right? So there's that sort of a kind of push for Spanish as being this really important political asset to these regions and to these Spanish speakers who both know the American side so well, but also do know the Spanish.
Great, thank you. So towards the, you know, the latter chapters of the book, you know, how does, you know, Spanish again as a political leader start to again evolve in the trajectory of your narrative, that is, particularly around World War II? You've mentioned Pan-Americanism as one thing, so we can go with that a little bit too, but what other ways in which, you know, Spanish is both being seen as a language of opportunity, mainly perhaps on the international scale, but then, you know, domestically, there's, you know, we've just gone through a few decades, that is, particularly the 20s, the 30s, in which nationalist sentiment, right, really consolidates around English, you know, and right, that English is, that the United States is an English only or an English speaking nation. So there's these two kind of competing forces, right?
Right. So you have dozens of states that make English be the only language that is allowed to be taught in the primary grades. And then you'll have different schools that will encourage Spanish in the eighth grade and up, right? So the message is very clear that you have to learn English first to be an American citizen. And then after that, it is very useful to have these other these other languages, and Spanish being the major one, right? So Spanish becomes the most learned modern language. It surpasses surpasses French in the 1940s, like right during the World War II. And a lot of that has to do with the larger movement towards Pan-Americanism, a lot of interest in it, but also the war itself. And these kind of, I mean, you've probably seen, you know, Walt Disney doing these movies, the good neighbor policy, and these desires to have these stronger connections with Latin America. And so there was a lot of discussion on how do we make the United States look good for these Latin American nations. And at the same time, there is discrimination and segregation and all these other things that are happening to Spanish speakers in the United States, right? So the Office of Inter-American Affairs during World War II in particular is one of the ways that the federal government really stands up for the first time for Spanish. And so it's mostly through school programs that are meant to kind of bridge the divide between Anglo and Spanish speakers. And so it's usually with immigrant communities, but not necessarily always. And there's a real desire for Spanish to be learned and also for English to be taught. So it's kind of both at the same time.
Right. Thank you. So after the you know, main set of chapters really kind of end with the right around World War II, the epilogue takes us a bit beyond that. We kind of provide a peek, you know, into or a glimpse into the implications for, you know, Spanish, you know, in, you know, the latter half of the 20th century. You try to, you know, just add a little bit of what you cover there in regards to, you know, how this carries out beyond World War II.
Right. So part of the reason I don't go into that period is that that's a period that's been so well studied by Chicano scholars or other scholars. And so, you know, Guadalupe San Miguel has covered very well the Bilingual Education Act, you know, all these sorts of things that come because of Chicanos advocating for the language, advocating for learning more about, you know, the history of Spanish speakers in the United States. That sort of history is better known. That you have, you know, CSO, Steve Pitty talks about the how the CSO would have these citizenship courses in Spanish for individuals who are older, right? And the 1952 Walter McCarran Act allows for those individuals who lived in the United States for a long period of time to take naturalization exams in Spanish. So you have a very different sort of story in the post-World War II period. You have the rise of Spanish in a, again, right? So through larger migrations that come in that period post-1965, but then again in the 1980s and 1990s, so you have a very different sort of population that comes into play. And for the most part, that earlier history by that point of treaty citizens of Spanish as a language of politics is forgotten by that period, right? So it's not really in play in the same way. But at the same time, there are very significant gains. Probably the most significant was in 1975 when the Voting Rights Act extended the language rights to voters who speak Spanish. So it, you know, 1965, the Voting Rights Act is what's well known, and it was in its extension in 10 years later is what allowed for ballots in certain counties to, under certain conditions, to be in other languages. And specifically, those were in certain Asian languages. They don't designate which ones, but most likely, you know, Chinese and in Spanish. So, and then Chinese is most likely, depending on what part of the country, is either Mandarin or Cantonese, right? So, so there's this national recognition of languages and language rights that comes in the 70s, along with many other, you know, civil rights sorts of gains that come into play. But for the most part, I feel that has been well covered by other scholars. And so I was really interested in that earlier history and finding where language politics was prior to that story.
Well, I think, and thank you for adding and explaining that. And in regards to your book, again, I mean, covering that 100-year period, if you will, you know, after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and the end of the U.S.-Mexico War, is such a needed history and story. It got me so much thinking about my, my own lifetime in California and how, you know, Spanish, the language itself, right, has been so politicized throughout my life. My parents, you know, were bilingual educators, and I'm thinking about the context that they dealt with. Bilingual education, particularly in California, was perceived in the 70s, the 80s, eventually getting banned in the 90s. Me growing up, with my parents as educators, as bilingual educators, there was just this feeling that, you didn't want to. And my parents never explained this to me, but it became clear to me that they didn't want their children being labeled, as English language learners or even bilingual, right? And now we're just at a completely different moment, right? Where bilingual education now is, I always forget the new term that they use for it, immersion, Spanish immersion or language immersion classes, right? And it's viewed as, of course, a benefit to children. And it sort of gives me whiplash to think about how fast this has all changed, particularly since the late 90s, which is, going from banning Spanish to just almost embracing it, at least at an institutional level, right? Both their education and political systems.
You have California overturning their ban on bilingual education, right? Yeah, so it's a huge shift in our lifetime, like you said. And I think that both of those sides of the coin in terms of Spanish as kind of being vilified, and I hear stories from so many individuals whose father didn't speak Spanish, but their grandmother did, and that they now do because they've gone out of their way to do it. So you can kind of see within family structures the ways that language politics has affected individuals at the most intimate levels, right? And I really love hearing those stories. So
true. You can really track it over generations, right? And kind of peg maybe even now with language fluency. I mean, my children, again, growing up in an era to where Spanish is so much more embraced, and that's not to gloss over the challenges still, and the nativist sentiment that still exists, not only in the state of California where you and I are speaking, but nationally as well. But it's it does seem clear to me that they are, they are approaching Spanish and having a hunger for, different languages, not just Spanish, growing up in a very multicultural society, that just, it wasn't something that I experienced, or of course my parents, right?
Right. No, I mean, for individuals that are in urban spaces, they can just look at billboards, right, and see them in different languages. They can hear it on the streets. They, it's a part of the life, right, style for many individuals daily. And so, so thinking back to the 19th century and hearing these different languages would not be something that we can't picture, right? Because we can imagine it, because it's what is reality in many places today.
I almost kind of wonder if then, and I hate to again just overly think about this, but how much, maybe we're getting to a point to where we were before then, at this initial moment, scholars, categorize these periods, of borderlands type of, multi-ethnic interaction where things are kind of up for grabs, so to speak. But just if we're maybe getting back to, and it's not a nostalgia that I'm trying to point out here, but just a point where, again, the languages that are using, the cultures that are used, we just become much more comfortable, right, with the variety and the diversity that is around us. And I know that's very local, local and regional, even within our own nation, but if somehow.
Well, I think that's it's a huge point in the politics of language in general that I do bring up in the book. And I talked about it a little bit with California and New Mexico, but language rights are regional and are state-based and locally based, right? So if you don't have something that restricts the use of language, then cities and towns and counties can have their own laws that allow for translations, or, Miami is a key example of this in terms of, the bilingualism that is there, right? So you can have that in specific regions, and it can be very locally based. And until the United States, at this point, they're one of only 8 nations in the entire world that does not have an official language, right? And so, and because of that, and because of, federalism in general, and not having to do what the federal government does with language at the more local or state level, it does allow for everyone's experience to be very different. We might be talking to somebody who is in North Dakota who says, "Oh no, I don't really see the language at all," right? But and so it can be very, the official language use can get it can be very much segmented into those different places. So individuals' realities is very much dependent on where they live then and today.
Right. You know, and that's something you bring out early on in the book. That kind of brings us in the role that federalism has played, right? In, you know, that is the multilingual, you know, nature, I guess, of, you know, of our country, as well as its multicultural, you know, type of, you know, diversity. And that as it expanded, right, the concept of federalism being the, you know, constitutional kind of guiding point of how territories are incorporated, getting to, you know, make decisions on their own, if you will, and that type of relationship and debate between the federal and states and territories is what allowed this kind of, you know, in ways, which is ad hoc and at times, you know, sort of arbitrary type of progression, right, to where I think, as you're right, it, various regions in this country, people just presume that, again, right, English has always been, you know, the language of the nation, the U.S. nation, and or even of that territory, at least within, you know, expansive memory since maybe even Native American periods, but in indigenous periods. But, you know, when you look to other regions, particularly this, you know, particularly California, the Southwest, you know, Spanish not only predated, of course, English as a European language that was being used in the region, but, you know, one that, you know, has continued, you know, throughout. All right. Well, thanks so much for your comments on that. I do want to give you one, you know, a moment to also share with us what you're working on now.
I'm working on my second book project, yeah, which I'm tentatively calling Intertwined Roots right now. And a lot of your last comment actually kind of segues well into it. And that's the fact that, you know, Spanish, while it is an American language, and it's an American language in multiple different ways, right? As a language of the Americas, right? American is not just for the United States, but also as a language of this nation and, you know, central to its creation. But also, it's not the first language that was here, of course. It is a European language. It came in later, and there were indigenous languages, and there was a long relationship between Spanish speakers and indigenous populations that continues through this entire period that we've been discussing. And so I'm looking at another kind of long-term, like 100-year study of the relationship between Mexican Americans and Native Americans, indigenous individuals who are mostly in Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado at this point is where I'm pinpointing. I am still figuring out sources and which particular, like if I want to focus on the Pueblo, or if I want to focus on Navajo, or if I, you know, which particular groups that I want to look at in relation to Mexican Americans. But I've located multiple different archives that I'm using to do this sort of project. And so I'm excited for it. And it's been fun to kind of read broadly again in a new field.
Great. Well, I'm excited for that. That sounds very fascinating, but you've given us plenty to think about.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you. I'm a longtime listener, big fan.